This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When you think of first examples of American music, the sound of Delta blues or New Orleans jazz might come to your ear. This music was birthed from black musicians. An American songbook owes much to black artists. June is African American Music Appreciation Month, so today we'll recognize a few of the many black artists who have shaped American music. It's part of this month's installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Joining me, as always, are Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How you doing, Frank?
Good. Natalie is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thanks, Frank.
Mark, you have written about the name change. It's African American Music Appreciation Month, which takes most of the month to say. It's a long one. It was shorter one time, right?
So when the month was founded in 1979, it's an idea that comes to fruition through Kenny Gamble, who of course is one of the architects behind Philadelphia International Records, and also the publishing collective, the Mighty Three, which included Leon Huff and Tom Bell. And he and his wife at the time, a very young Deanna Williams, came up with this idea of a Black Music Month as a way to both celebrate the heritage of Black music in this country, but also to have this kind of moment where some of the record companies would devote some marketing money, right, to be able to allow Black artists to kind of mainstream. There was always clearly a kind of corporate capitalist intention here, you know, where you could kind of celebrate the legacy at the same time and sell some records. And, of course, when President Obama became president and wanted to acknowledge that, it got rebranded as African American Music Appreciation Month, which on the surface seems like it's not such a big deal. But if you think about the shift between Black and African American, there's something distinctly political about the term Black that gets lost in the term African American, right? And all kinds of research has suggested that. And, you know, I think out loud about if it's suddenly African American Music Appreciation Month, right, what do you do to the legacy of someone like Bob Marley or Fela Kuti or Miriam Makeba, none of which who were African Americans, right, but black artists and politically important, particularly in this particular moment.
Right. And I think that there's a fluidity, that black music has, that in different artists of different locales inform each other. You know, for instance, I know there are a lot of the black British soul was informed by people like Stevie Wonder and I can't think of anybody else, but there were people from the 70s, you know, but it was American, black American music that informed that movement. And so when you limit it to African American, which is very specific to the United States, then you do exclude this whole body of work that, you know, really you can't separate our music from the rest of the diaspora.
Right. And talking, too, about the importance of it and the significance of it, you talked about co-founder of the month, Deanna Williams, who, you know, was very open about the fact that this is a marketing tool. But in the same breath, that means it's going to have cultural significance. Let's listen to Deanna Williams.
The reaction once we launched the concept of Black Music Month, which I must say was inspired by the Country Music Association, because they have a very strong aggregation of music industry professionals. That was the inspiration for Kenny Gamble when he decided, let's create a month where we get to celebrate the contributions of those past, the legacy individuals who helped build the music business, as well as people currently in the business and generations to come. So it is an opportunity, much like Black History Month, to celebrate, acknowledge not just the cultural contributions, but the multi-billion dollar industry that is black music. So it is a celebration of commerce and culture and America's indigenous music forms.
It's the co-founder of Black Music Month, Deanna Williams, talking on WNBM in New York City last month. And the significance of this, Mark, and we've talked about this too, the idea that you can't really separate the commerce from the cultural production. This is how things get made, right? And they may have certainly an influence on your pocketbook, but also they do change and shape the way we understand our culture.
Oh, absolutely. I think when you think about black culture just historically, the only ways in which it has been able to move the needle, if you will, to be able to capture the attention of white America is through the commercial vein. It's in the marketplace. When you see the success of a Broadway play, for instance, like Shuffle Along, song, you know, going back to U.B. Blake and Noble Sissle and their first, you know, mounting of the show back in 1921, they were very clear about the fact that this was an attempt to show a broader American audience about Black songwriting, about, you know, Black playwrights, about the fullness of Black expressive culture. And you really only get a chance to do that in the marketplace, which is seen as kind of a safe space, if you will.
And I think it's interesting that, and I really appreciate the fact that Gamble, in Kenny Gamble in particular, really understood this whole connection between the political and the commercial, and that he made it work and was able to push messages that were affirming of the Black experience through a commercially viable means, which was the music. And it's interesting when I think about someone like Beyoncé, who has gotten so much flack from people like Bell Hooks and others who, you know, basically critique her for being a commercial, well, being a commodity. But at the same time, like, how does she get her artistry out there without the commercial means? Right, so you can't really have one without the other.
But you talked about it being a success, and in some ways it certainly is, and in other ways it wasn't, particularly when the message is overtly political. And I think here we can talk about Philadelphia International Records signing Billy Paul, who has an enormous commercial success in Me and Mrs. Jones, and then things change a little bit when he does more political songs. Talk a little bit about Billy Paul, first of all.
So, you know, he's an interesting figure. And of course, Billy Paul passed away a few months ago. And, you know, he's an older artist. He's very mature, has a very sense of what his style and sensibility is. He's also someone who has many talents, right? He can sing jazz, he can sing R&B, he can sing show tunes. So Gamble & Huff, which in the early days of Philadelphia International Record, made sure to sign acts that they didn't have to, you know, create, right? That already had their kind of own sensibilities. Billy Paul obviously was one of them. But his breakthrough hit is Me and Mrs. Jones, which goes to the top of the pop charts. And the follow-up single is a song called Am I Black Enough For You? And 30 years later, folks are still like, who would think that that was a good idea as a follow-up track, right? You've crossed over to the mainstream, yeah, right, on a song that, you know, sounds like a little show tune. You're sitting in, mm-hmm, the cafe, you know, doing all kinds of things. And now you're going to have a protest song called Am I Black About You? But on several, it spoke to how Gamble and Huff saw their label as doing some very real political work in the marketplace. And they were hoping that at least Billy Paul, because he had had that commercial success, would be able to translate that in ways that, say, some of their lesser-known artists wouldn't have been able to.
I mean, they saw themselves as direct competition to Berry Gordy, right?
Absolutely.
In Motown,
absolutely,
Records. Well, let's hear that and get it back in your ear for people of a certain age. They have not gotten this out of their ear yet. This is the big hit for Billy Paul.
Holding hands, making all kinds of plans, while the jukebox plays a favorite song. Me and Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Jones. We got a thing.
I have to say, just personally, aesthetically, I've always been amazed at that song. The phrasing is just incredible. I listen over and over. On the other hand, having a thing with Mrs. Jones, I'm seeing her, she's hanging her laundry in the yard. I'm not having a thing with her.
So, yeah, you know, it's so funny to me that to hear this song again, because it takes me back to my childhood, and I remember when I was first exposed to this song. I can't even remember how. I think I had a radio in my room, but my mom was like, you are not listening to this. Like, she basically forbade me to listen to it. But, you know, the thing about Me and Mrs. Jones, like, as an adult, I can look back at it and I realize that even though it was a commercial success, there's still a bit of a political edge in it, in that the song is illuminating an aspect of African-American life, right, that, you know, otherwise would, yeah, not be talked about or told. And I think that's why it resonated. I mean, because it's a universal truth, you know, but it's, right, also something about, and it is so smooth and suave, yeah, like, you know, it's attractive, it's appealing.
Transgressive in the sense that this is not a thing that African Americans should be talking about. We don't want to expose this thing.
And created moments for other transgression. So, you know, there's a group in the 1970s called the Dynamic Superiors who have a popular song called Shoo Shoo Shine. Their lead singer, Tony Washington, was out, you know, out before Sylvester, out for many folks. And in concert, he would perform a version of Me and Mrs. Jones as Me and Mr. Jones. You know, know, tongue in cheek, you know, at a moment where no one wants to acknowledge that this kind of reality. But the fact that it was coming from a black artist speaks to the very things Natalie talks about. There was some sense of transgression that was already embedded, you know, in that track.
Yeah. But just to give you a sense, because you probably didn't hear this one, Am I Black Enough for You by Billy Paul, again, 1972. Let's just listen to this. Billy Paul, Am I Black Enough for You? That's got everything going for it, Motown-wise, except the message is, oops, we are not going to cross over with this one, right?
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, but, you know, the fact that it's Billy Paul, whose voice is so smooth, you know, he really is, and you know, in my limited knowledge of just the soul period, because I'm really a contemporary of Mark.
You're too young to remember.
I'm not at all.
You're too young
not
to remember.
Not at all.
Really.
Just a few years younger than Mark. But, but I mean, I just think that it's, you know, it's like there's this deep political message in the midst of this beautiful music, you know? And it's unfortunate that something like that, which especially at the time, I would think resonated so much because of the Black Power movement and all that was going on, you know, in terms of social justice and the fight for that. But, you know, it's very in your face and at the same time.
We're going to take a break right now and come back. My guest, pop culture experts, Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. We're talking today about, it's African-American Music Appreciation Month. It's Back Channel on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guests are pop culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. They're with me for another installment of Back Channel, connecting culture and context. And today, the culture and the context are African American music. This being African American Music Appreciation Month, Black music. We're expanding that to include the diaspora. But we're going to talk now about Prince, who died earlier this in April. And I want to talk about personally how you both were introduced to Prince and kind of your first memories of Prince. Natalie, let me start with you.
Well, I'm going to try and get through this because Prince was probably even more than Michael Jackson. He was really the soundtrack and one of the main artists that influenced me and really impacted the way that I began to think about myself in my formative years. I mean, I was introduced to him by mainly through 1999. I'd heard music from For You and from, I think, Controversy before that. But 1999 really struck home with me, I guess because I was old enough for it to really resonate. But I think the thing about Prince that I just, you know, will always appreciate and always love and will always, you know, make me teary-eyed when I think about him passing at such an early age, is that he was, you know, he was the embodiment of acceptance and inclusion and tolerance in at a time when, you know, we weren't talking about it. It wasn't even something that was on the radar. And so Prince really set a tone for me. I mean, he has always been like a cousin or, you know, a brother almost in my mind. I have a really good friend in Chicago who I've known since we were 10. And her grandmother, whenever Prince would be on television, would call her and say, your sister is on. And, you know, it's because of his androgynous, you know, presence. But, you know, we would always laugh at that. But, you know, we felt that. We felt this kinship with Prince in a way that I don't think I have ever felt that for another artist, and I don't know that I ever will. There was something really special and very powerful about not only what he did musically, but just his presence in the culture and what he meant.
Mark?
My mother bought his second album. There's a track on it called I Want to Be Your Lover, and that was my introduction to Prince. But I also, you know, embraced him with a certain level of ambivalence because I'm looking at the album, right? He's shirtless, and you know, and my 13-year-old self is saying, "My, this is a really pretty man. I don't really know what to do with this."
Right.
And then, like,
right.
he's naked on the horse on the back. I'm like, okay, what is this? And I kind of don't follow him after that, but it is that 1999 album, which just in terms of what it does musically, I mean, folks forget this is an album that comes out 2 months before Michael Jackson's Thriller. And folks aren't really thinking about Michael the same way. I mean, these two, and they're close to the same age. Yep. They both drop career-defining albums within months of each other. Michael crosses over in this major way. But, you know, we all see Prince as this transgressive figure, both around racial identity in terms of gender, clearly in terms of sexuality, right? I often joke about the fact you look at the four men who, you know, really represented R&B music in the early 1980s. Michael Jackson, Prince, Luther Vandross, and Rick James, right? And they're all, you know, playing around with androgynous looks. You know, Luther Vandross is rumored to be a homosexual. And you might not have been sure about Prince's sexuality, but you were clear that he was having sex. you don't know who he was having sex with, but unlike all of those other figures, you were clear, right, that he was having sex.
Yes, he was.
Well, what is it about androgyny, particularly in communities where homosexuality is difficult? And I'm thinking, too, I'm going back to Elvis now, who I think is this androgynous figure who allows Southern white men to embrace a kind of body, and they're only comfortable with that because they hear girls screaming, so they know it's cool to be okay with his hips and his lips. And I've always felt that about Elvis, that this, you know, in the same thing. But that's kind of an element in this, that there's a port, there's a way for you to identify wherever you are.
I think that that's an interest. It's very interesting to think about Elvis, you know, sort of in a similar way as Prince, at least. But Prince had the same thing. I mean, in spite of the ruffles, in spite of, you know, he might come on stage with a thong on, or, you know, his hair might have more curls than, you know, one of the females in his band. But the women would be throwing their panties at the stage. Yeah. Right. And so and certainly, yes, like I love what Mark said about you might not be clear about his sexuality, but you knew that dude was having sex. Yeah. You knew that.
And that was part of the brilliance and the insiderness of the Dave Chappelle skit about Prince, right? Why is Eddie Murphy and all these cats wanting to hang out with Prince if Prince represents this thing that they're not trying to be? Well, because, you know, Prince got all the girls, right?
That's right. right. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about this. We also asked our listeners to respond today, and we got a response from Kendra about her memories of Prince.
My name is Kendra Maltzy-Mudd, and I live in Durham, North Carolina. I'd like to recognize Prince Rogers Nelson, to many known as Prince, and at one time also known as the Symbol. Prince was my first boyfriend. When the Purple Rain album came out, and I believe it was 1985, I was under the age of 10, and I very much remember him being one of the first artist that I was captivated by. I only want to see you laughing in the purple rain, purple rain. Purple rain, purple rain. He created a movement in music. He was an artist that clearly was passionate about the sound of music, but he was also passionate and very astute in the business aspect of music. He believed in the power of music, and he wanted that to be his own, and he wanted to own the sound that he created. So I think the influence, touches not only musicians, but as a business person, when you really think about why he protested, why he took a stance, why he stopped making music, it speaks volumes to the type of person that he was. I have an 8-year-old child, and I can still play his music, and it has the same impact and effect on my child that it did on me at the same age in which, you know, I discovered Prince.
It's Kendra Maltzy-Mudd talking about Prince and her ideas about him and the way she helped form her identity. And we're talking with pop culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal today.
I just wanted to jump in behind what Kendra said about the impact of Prince on a totally new generation, you know, her 8-year-old son. because I think that that Prince has had a similar impact on my children. My children know him, but kind of through the back door. My daughter dances. She does ballet. So she knows about Prince because Misty Copeland danced with him. My son is just a musician in his own right, and at least in his mind. And he is attracted to all kinds of music. And I have to say, like, in the days following Prince's death, there was a pop-up tribute to Prince in Durham. And I didn't think that my kids would want to go. And my son was like, oh, yeah, I'm there, you know. And he came with me. He stuck it out, watching Purple Rain being projected on the wall. And, you know, he had very interesting reactions to some of the lyrics that he heard. But he understood. He seemed to intuitively understand, number one, how important Prince was, at least to me, and to all the people that were gathered there. And then secondly, that Prince was creative, and his artistic genius was something that you definitely have to acknowledge and pay attention to. And that's enduring. You know, his music is going to be with us, you know, till the end of time.
And he got the business, too. He understood absolutely. That owning the music was an important thing, and he reflected on that. And I guess this is the other question mark, is when he becomes overtly political and when not, and kind of these decisions about music that is going to talk directly about some kind of an issue.
You know, for Prince, the initial political piece was about the ownership of his music, right? Both the ownership and who had the right to curate his music, right? So his falling out with Warner Brothers is really about the fact that he had a level of productivity in which he wanted to release music in a way that was fundamentally counter to the industry and what Warner Brothers wanted in terms of, you know, maximizing profit. I mean, that's where he becomes politicized. He has this great line in one of his 12 inches, I wish you heaven, where he's like, take this beat, I don't mind, I got plenty others. Right? He's like, I'm an endless well of creativity, and there needs to be a forum and a foundation for me to be able to share that, which is why he's one of the early adopters of digital music, right? He understands before there are streaming services and before Napster, he understands the value of digitizing music and making it available to a wider public without going to the traditional means of distribution.
So in 2001, here's his cover of When Will We Be Paid? Hey, let's listen.
We brought in your walls in every land to keep this country free, y'all. For women, children, and men. But anytime we ask for pay or loan, that's when everything seems to turn out wrong.
You got the clip of the 2001 Prince cover, When Will We Be Paid? Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown today on Back Channel.
So this is the thing, right? This is a cover at the time of a almost 40-year-old staple singer's song, right? This is a song that Mavis and Cleotha and pop staples are singing in the mid-1960s, which, first of all, gives us some indication of how politicized they were, right? Mm-hmm. So that when they're singing I'll Take You There in 1971, this is really some Afrofuturistic sensibilities here, right? We're taking you to freedom, right? Mm-hmm. This is not just a funk song for you to dance at a party. But Prince embraces this, again, because of his tensions with the record company and ownership of his creativity. And this is what, 14 years before Ta-Nehisi Coates is talking about reparations in the nation, right? This is or the Atlantic, right? This is important work, right? So he's talking about this and connecting it to a larger political moment. And of course, when you understand then that he understands what's happening around Baltimore and Freddie Gray, and he holds a concert and releases a song, right? And of course, he's had this long history that no one knew about till after his death of philanthropy, supporting the United Negro
College Fund.
College Fund, supporting, coding programs in San Francisco, you know, the stuff that Van Jones has been talking about he did. It's a really fascinating career in that regard, that he chose to keep certain things on the DL and found a way to be political and could be political because he didn't need the mainstream music industry in order to make music and support what he was doing.
Right. And I think, you know, also it speaks to like all of it goes together, right? This integrity that Prince had. There was the artistic integrity. He was determined to have control over his masters, but he's also determined to support whatever he wanted to support and to be political in whatever ways that he wanted to. And he did not have to have the shine that comes along with dropping, you know, large amounts of money for a cause.
Right.
He did not want people to know. And it wasn't, I'm sure, because he you know, he didn't want people to know because he, you know, somehow thought that that was going to have an impact on his career. I don't think he cared about that, because I think, as Mark said, he knew the power that he had in owning what he produced.
Well, it seems to me it puts a finger directly on the nexus, this paradox or difficulty that people have understanding. Well, if African American, you know, performers do so well, we're post-racial. Obviously, look at where you see African American faces. All well, yeah, you can be there as long as you don't own it.
Right.
As long as it's not yours, we're happy to watch you perform.
I mean, the standard recording contract historically is that, you know, the artist gets about 7% of the profits, right?
Yeah.
So when Prince is talking about if you don't own your masters, the master owns
right.
you, right? That's very real politics. Most artists don't even own their publishing rights.
Right.
The irony of Prince's death is that in the hours after his death, everyone is trying to get up on the streaming services to listen to his music. And if you don't actually physically own some of Prince's music on a CD, a cassette, or an album, right? You had to go to Tidal,
right?
And when he won back his master recordings from Warner Brothers, he chose Tidal, the company owned by Jay-Z and Beyonce and other folks.
Yeah.
The only place you could get his music, was there, right? And that was by choice, because they have a mechanism that's probably not the best that it could be, right? But is much more beneficial and less exploitive than some of the other music streaming services are for artists.
Mm-hmm.
Before the segment ends, I want to talk about Fife Dog, too, who also passed, and a little bit about his legacy. Talk more about him. Mark, tell us how Fife changed hip-hop. With A Tribe Called Quest.
I mean, groundbreaking with A Tribe Called Quest. I think if you think about hip hop, they are probably one of the eight pillars of hip hop in terms of how they move the audience and move aesthetics and even move politics. And he was a less flashy, you know, Q-Tip was a much more flashier figure there. But, you know, Fife always reminded me of the cat that was like the everyday guy,
right?
The dude you would
see
in the barbershop, right? You might see Q-Tip in the club, but you would see Fife in the barbershop. And what he was writing about and his concerns and clearly the struggles that he had with diabetes made him someone that was so much more accessible, you know, to the rank and file fans of hip hop and even the black community, right, because of those kinds of issues.
Yep.
Well, let's hear a clip from a song, Oh My God.
Trini Gladiator, anti-hesitator, Shahid push the Vader, from here to Grenada, Mr. Energetic, who me sound pathetic, when's the last time you heard a funky diabetic?
Now, what about that? I mean, there he is talking about his own condition, diabetes, which he spoke often about that and openly about that. I mean, also a contribution. But musically, I think, where does he fit? You talked about who he was personally and how he fit in the group. But in the genealogy of the music, where does Tribe Called Quest fit?
I think, you know, Fife is really important to this because of how hard he worked. When they dropped their first album, People's Instinctive Travels, he was not a very prominent figure on the album. Right. You know, Q-Tip clearly stood out. But by the time they got around to their follow up album, he had brought his game up, if you will. And to the extent that I think pound for pound, if you look at he and Q-Tip, you know, he might have come off as a stronger lyricist, you know, when all was said and done. And again, this kind of commitment to the everyday notion of hip hop that remains accessible to the community. You know, when we think about groups even like, you know, here in North Carolina, we look at Little Brother. When we think about Kendrick Lamar, when we think about Chance the Rapper out of Chicago, you know, these are all groups that Lupe Fiasco out of Chicago. I mean, these are all acts that you couldn't even imagine without A Tribe Called Quest being in the room. And ironically, they talk about how they were inspired by a group like N.W.A., you know, trying to create a kind of sonic landscape that was very East Coast and jazz oriented. That was the other thing about Tribe Called Quest, right? They went deep into the jazz archives, you know, to create their kind of sound. You know, really influential group, and of course he was a key figure.
And a legacy? Do we hear them today? How has that music?
Oh, I think definitely when you talk about Chance the Rapper and when you talk about Kendrick Lamar, you're hearing the resonances of A Tribe Called Quest.
And I think, you know, one of the things that I love about Tribe is that, and actually Fife's cousin wrote a really beautiful sort of tribute to him in the wake of his death, where she talks about how Fife and Tribe, you know, basically appealed to black weirdos, like made it okay to be that. And I think that there is a population within the black community. Certainly there are hip hop heads who, you know, love hip hop, I mean, regardless of the, I guess, genre. But for me, Tribe was extremely accessible because I was a jazz head, but also because, you know, there was something about my sensibilities that didn't quite, I couldn't quite get with gangster rap. you know, it just didn't resonate with me in the same way that it might have with other people. But Tribe allowed me to participate in hip hop in a way that I probably wouldn't have really been able to into the early 90s without that connection. And certainly, you know, what Q-Tip was talking about in juxtaposition to what Fife was talking about. I mean, Q-Tip has all these lofty sort of ideas lyrically, and Fife is very on the ground, very accessible in a way that when you bring them together, I mean, it's pure magic, and, you know, we owe a lot to them.
Talking to Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal today on Back Channel, and the State of Things continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guests, pop culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal, on Back Channel, connecting culture and context. Today, talking about African-American Music Appreciation Month, but we're going to move on to talk about the legacy, the life and legacy of Muhammad Ali. Let's talk about the importance of this. You know, a number of people have talked about Muhammad Ali as a guy who has transcended race, but I wonder if that's really an accurate way to look at Muhammad Ali. It seems maybe not quite right.
You know, to echo my friend Bomani Jones, I mean, it's disrespectful, for lack of a better way to describe it. You know, it speaks to the fact that Muhammad Ali was a byproduct of race in America, right? That the changing of his name is a reality to that. The 4 years that he's forced to sit out of his career, you know, is a byproduct of that. The hatred that white America largely had for Muhammad Ali until he couldn't speak back to that hatred. You know, really until the Olympics in 1996, and he's so beaten down that he becomes a sympathetic figure. I mean, up to that point in time, there's still parts of white America that are not friends of Muhammad Ali. So to say that somehow he transcended races is, you know, being intellectually disingenuous, right?
Right. And, you know, I think there's an interview that Dave Zirin did on Democracy Now! That Mark has featured on his blog that I think is so interesting, because Dave Zirin says that Muhammad Ali's funeral or memorial service was like his last moment of resistance, because everyone that had some sort of hatred towards him, everyone that might have had a hand in basically his persecution, you know, has to bow to him in this final moment, you know, and to a Muslim at a moment in our country's history where we've got a presidential candidate who's running on a platform that is all about anti-Muslim sentiment.
Right, right.
So it's really interesting how, you know, from like his integrity, his legacy is intact throughout. Like, there is no break in it. He is who he was in the 60s when he was at his peak, all the way till now. He has not backed off of that that pro-black, that pro-Muslim, anti-war, inclusive stance.
Inclusive, and yet was always pressed. Remember, this is the 60s now. We're moving into the early 70s. Integration is still kind of on everybody's mind. And so liberal white America is saying, well, look, why can't we all learn to get together? It's not all white people, is it, Muhammad Ali? I mean, tell us it's not all of us. And he said, well, kind of, yeah, it is. Let's listen to this. Here's an interview in 1971, the British program Parkinson. Let's listen.
There are many white people who mean right and in heart want to do right. But there are so few. If 10,000 rattlesnakes was coming down that aisle now, and I had a door here I could shut, and in that 10,000, 1,000 meant right, 1,000 rattlesnakes didn't want to bite me. I knew they were good. Should I let all these rattlesnakes come down, hoping that 1,000 get together and form a shield? Or should I just close the door and stay safe?
I think that...
You understand? The Viet Cong are not all bad, but America's still dropping bombs. In Hiroshima, the Japan wasn't bad, but she still dropped a bomb. In Korea, they weren't bad, but they still dropped a bomb. So now I'm going to forget the 400 years of lynching and killing and raping and depriving my people of freedom, justice, and equality, the first fired, last hired, the lowest of low, last respected, and I'm going to look at 2 or 3 white people who are trying to do right and don't see the other million trying to kill me. I'm not that big of a fool.
There we go.
Lord, Muhammad Ali dropping bars.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and unrepentant. And again, you know, sort of like the way we talk about Beyonce, he could have just kept knocking people out and made money and gone beyond all this. He didn't need this kind of strife, and he kept, you know, stepping into the center of the ring and throwing those kind of punches brilliantly.
You know, folks never quite figure out, you know, how he ends up in the Nation of Islam. You know, because you always have to remind folks that when even Black America thought about Cassius Clay, because of all the jokes and all the clowning and all the story, I mean, he's somewhere around 2 Chainz level, you know, even with the Olympic gold medal in 1960. And Malcolm X was, you know, had always said that what he saw in Ali was not someone who was a clown, but there was something much deeper going on, right? That he was essentially gaming the system, right, with his performances, right? And that's what you see Ali do throughout his career. He essentially games the system, but not on his own basis, not for his own gain,
right,
but for things that he was committed to and communities that he was committed to.
A serious devotee of the Nation of Islam, which he credits for helping rebuild and restore his identity and allowing him to be as outspoken as he was. And it's interesting because I know in these conversations, we can often get lofty and sometimes it sounds academic to talk about who controls the narrative and, you know, these media images and black bodies, et cetera. But here's a guy who really very deeply got it initially. And in the 1960s, you remember the show Firing Line with William F. Buckley. So I went back and I listened to one and watched one, actually, with Muhammad Ali and William Buckley Jr. And I want to set this up. So Buckley gives us 2-minute introduction. Which, just to give you an idea, our intros are probably around 20 to 30 seconds. So if you want to compare, 2-minute essay that sets up the interview that you're about to hear. I'm going to play a 40-second clip from William F. Buckley's introduction of Muhammad Ali. Let's listen.
In 1942 in Louisville, Kentucky, Mr. and Mrs. Cassius Marcellus Clay christened their newborn son Cassius Clay Jr. 22 years later, Cassius Clay renounced his name and its associations and elected to call himself Muhammad Ali, which is, of course, how we shall refer to him tonight. Even as tomorrow, should he change his name back, we would refer to him as Cassius Clay. In changing his name, Muhammad Ali intended to disavow his culture and to adopt membership in the Black Muslim movement of which he is an apostle.
All right, there we go. So right off the bat, I want to play Muhammad Ali's response before he even says hello. Let's listen.
I would like to thank you for the brief introduction. You covered a lot of space in such a short time. You did make a few points that I would like to straighten up, and I'm sure you did
this
without knowledge of what you were saying. When I did not take the name, or just name myself Cassius Clay, this is an honorable name, Muhammad Ali, given to me by my religious leader and teacher, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And I would like to say that Muhammad means in Arabic, one who's worthy of praise is one praiseworthy, and Ali means the Most High. But the slave name Clay meant dirt with no ingredients. But
the slave word which?
Clay means dirt with no ingredients. Names have meanings in different countries. And I also would like to say that I'm not an apostle of the Muslim religion. We believe that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is the apostle of Allah God. But I'm only a helper and a minister of his. And I also like to say that you mentioned that when I accepted Cassius Clay, I disowned or disannounced my culture. Well, I did not disregard my culture. If I did, it was the white American culture. And I've accepted my true culture when I accepted Muhammad Ali, because this is a black name. Islam is the black man's religion. And so I would like to say that I would like to clarify that point, that I reclaimed my real culture And that's being a black man and wearing a black name with a black body and not a white name.
Muhammad Ali on Firing Line in the 1960s. Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal are with me. I mean, I just think that the idea that he absolutely knew what was happening in that moment. You're framing this thing in a way that I will be on the defensive the whole time. And maybe it takes a boxer to know you don't want to be on your back foot the whole time. He heard the frame. He understood the setup. And he said, I'm going to frame this interview now. And then we can move forward.
Yeah.
And without the high-flown rhetoric either. I mean, I think that's interesting, too. He doesn't blow up into the kind of fighter, boxerly, reverend, you know, minister's sermon.
No, it's a very accessible language, right,
yeah.
You know, in which he debunks, right, the narratives about him. I mean, so much of what, you know, inspired him in this particular moment is that, you know, he's deemed 4-H earlier on because the Army says that he's not smart enough. Right. And then when he becomes political, then suddenly, no, this is a time in which, you know, you can go through.
Right.
And so I think he always had a sense that the terrain would shift because of who he was. And give him credit for willing to stand toe-to-toe with someone like William F. Buckley. I mean, again, this is a moment where he needs to be visible. He needs the money. You know, he's not fighting. He needs to be able to speak at college campuses. And what better way to do this than to take on someone like Buckley? You know, but Buckley, you know, my favorite conservative, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, Buckley was an intellectual giant, right,
yeah.
In that particular moment, right? He read everything. He knew everything. I mean, you see conversations with him with folks like Stokely Carmichael. I mean, this is amazing stuff. And Ali's like, I'm good.
Yeah.
I think that Muhammad Ali is you know, in his iconic role within the culture, he is, to me, similar to people like Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, examples of excellence at the highest level, integrity, just an authenticity and a unwillingness to violate who they are, that, you know, I think, you know, he's a great example for anyone who is aspiring to just stand and deliver in the face of oppression or persecution, right, or, you know, challenges that might seem insurmountable, and to do it in a way that isn't defensive. He knew exactly who he was. And that's what, I mean, I think all of his responses to white America's jabs and pokes at him, it was grounded and anchored in the fact that he knew exactly who he was. And he wasn't going to apologize, as you said earlier. He was non-repentant, you know. And I think that that's an important thing for us to grab from Muhammad Ali. That's
Buckley,
a part of his legacy.
Buckley asks him in the interview, you know, you say that you're being persecuted because of your race. Why did the same nation embrace Joe Lewis and not you, if race was the issue? And it gets back to what we were talking about earlier. And Ali said it, he said, because he's humble and I'm not. You know, I mean, he didn't say it that way, but the point was, he was the kind of Negro you want, and mm-hmm. I'm not. And mm-hmm. that's why you don't embrace mm-hmm. me. He was very clear about mm-hmm. that, and mm-hmm. and also said it's in many cases, especially with the draft board, it wasn't my race, but my religion. It was my
right.
radicalization
right.
that drew attention
right.
to me. My
right.
race, you know, was not the issue because,
right.
yeah.
as you pointed out, he was already rejected. I want to make the comparison between him and Paul Robeson, too, because here is another virile African-American, a black man who stands up and is outspoken, but who is, in many ways is treated differently, who doesn't, I mean, Ali is able to at least, you know, sort of, well, he lost his crown too, I suppose, but to some extent remain in the country anyway. Is there a comparison here, Mark?
I think absolutely. I mean, they were both interesting, right, athletes that kind of shifted into an intellectual terrain. I mean, we mainly think about Robeson as an intellectual now, forgetting that both he was a letterman at Rutgers and also, you know, was an actor. But, you know, where Robeson's radicalism came from the Communist Party, right, and communism and what was deemed as anti-American at the time, I think black folks were less willing to close ranks around Paul Robeson in ways that, even given the kind of marginalization of Islam in the 1960s and the fact that the rank and file black folks, you know, were not going to join the Nation of Islam, right? That was never going to happen. You know, Ali at least had the cover of Malcolm X's legacy and Malcolm X's willingness to say things publicly about white supremacy that historically had never happened again. So even if folks weren't down with the Nation of Islam or black Muslims, you know, as they referred to at the time, they understood the power of the politics. Robeson didn't get that kind of protection in his era.
And it's interesting. Listen to this clip. He was asked on Australian television in 1960 The Australian commentator asks him, do you consider yourself an American? Listen to this answer.
I would say that unquestionably, I am an American, born there. My father slaved there. Upon the backs of my people was developed the primary wealth of America, the primary wealth. You have to have accumulated wealth to start, you know, to build. You did it another way here in Australia. You had to build your accumulated wealth too. You just came and took it, you know what I mean? And that's what they did in most of the countries. It's what you West, that's what you Europeans did. You just took it. We got to catch up with you a little bit. And so in America, so there's a lot of America that belongs to me yet, you understand? But just like a Scottish American is proud of being from Scotland, I'm proud for being African. Now in our school books, they tried to tell me that all Africans were savages. Till I got to London and found most of the Africans I knew were going to Oxford and Cambridge and doing very well, and learned their culture. And even once somebody had the temerity, after one had conquered the Chinese people and imposed upon them the opium trade and everything else, to suggest that they were a backward people, just the people who had been civilized so long over the rest of you folks, didn't make any sense at all. So somewhere, it was wonderful to find about the colored peoples of the world that they were very advanced. So I would say today that I'm an American who is infinitely prouder to be of African descent, no question about it.
Paul Rope's an actor and singer on Australian television in 1960s. I mean, there's a comparison. He's saying very much the same thing, although he uses a sort of Marxist critique, and obviously Muhammad Ali come from a religious critique. But both of them, and what do you make of the fact that both of them sort of use these structures outside of the mainstream American framework to say, here's how I can construct an identity and reasonably critique what's going on here? I have to almost stand apart from this and still maintain my identity as an American from this framework of another, a political or a religious framework.
I think it's important because I think someone like Ali and Robeson in this regard, they give a perception of the world that many African Americans don't have at the time. Right, because they're traveling outside of the country, right, because they're aware of what's happening globally, you know, they can offer a kind of critique that, you know, the rank and file black person can't because they have no knowledge of what happens outside of their small town in Mississippi or Georgia or someplace like that. And I think that's part of the threat. I mean, the other part of the threat, you know, about someone like Ali is that Ali is young. You know, when you think about that small period of time where he and Sam Cooke and Jim Brown and Malcolm X have a relationship, he's the youngest person in the room, right? And so he becomes critical, as does Jim Brown, as athletes to be able to connect to young black people in ways that Sam Cooke and even Malcolm X couldn't at that time.
And it's interesting. I'm just thinking about, you know, the fact that in the 60s, when Muhammad Ali was really asserting himself in the ways that we've been discussing, you know, we have O.J. Simpson also, you know, in the spotlight, but in direct opposition to who Muhammad Ali represented. Right. And then we also have Angela Davis, who is, you know, in some ways, I see connections between her and Robeson because of the communism, right? And the fact that in so many ways, even though the work that she did in terms of political social justice and trying to free political prisoners, you know, was very important. She never achieved the heights of a Martin Luther King or a Malcolm X and others.
Or even a Robeson.
Or even a Robeson, right? And that's partly because she was a woman. But also, I mean, I think that this communist idea is, you know, part of what keeps her from really connecting with the rest of the black community.
You know, the Ali Simpson thing for me is important because while Simpson is transcending race, running through airports
like
for her in the
1970s,
right? Ali is pitching for Decon roach spray, right? And Ali is infinitely a much more well-known and popular and globally known figure, but he was never going to be able to transcend race in the way that O.J. Simpson did in the mid-1970s.
Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, that was this episode of Back Channel on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.